Welcome to another edition of KUAR Public Radio's Week in Review podcast. We'll have a look at what a much-anticipated report on the foster care system offers to those children forced to sleep in DHS offices.
Arkansas continues to grapple with a healthcare overhaul. What steps is the state looking to take?
As expected, Arkansas's congressional delegation has no love for the president's nuclear deal with Iran.
We'll take a look at the week that was just ahead.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman. This week, we saw the governor talk about a report that was released previously that you had reported on before, Sarah, by Paul Vincent, and spurred by, of course, the saga dating back with Justin Harris and what it taught us a little bit about the foster care system in Arkansas and child placement with DHS. Can you tell us a little bit about what the governor talked about this week?
Well, the governor said that he accepted the finding of the report and he has embraced this issue. He recently created an interfaith collaborative group to address foster care and prison overcrowding, so he was already publicly speaking about the problem. The most significant aspect of this is that about a fifth of the foster children in the state don't have homes through the foster care system currently. So about 1,200 out of roughly 4,000 don't have a place through the foster system. And then beyond that, the caseload of workers is around 30 foster kids per case.
And that's well above the national average.
That's almost twice the average. The state gets almost more than twice the average of maltreatment reports and as a national average, and is significantly higher than surrounding states. Texas has a rate of 28.2 per 1,000 children, and Arkansas has 72.9. Missouri is at 56. And the governor noted that there are more reports in the state, so that might account for a slightly higher reporting average. About 22% of those reports in the last few months were substantiated. So that reflects a significant problem both with the issues that kids are facing in the state and the inability of the system as it's working now to meet the needs of the kids.
And this report gave us an overview of some things that have been going on for a while, stuff that I imagine a lot of people in DHS have probably been begging for lawmakers to pay attention to. So they've given us an overview of some of the problems. There are also 11 recommendations in this report. Is that right?
So one recommendation was that the governor assigned someone from his office to coordinate between the various agencies that are involved with working with the kids, and he has selected someone from his office to do that. Other recommendations involved funding for more caseworkers and for more foster beds. And so the governor has asked the legislature to allot $8 million over 3 years to support the foster system. So this is Governor Asa Hutchinson speaking about his response to the report finding.
I accept the recommendations that have been made, and as governor, we're going to work to achieve those recommendations. I think they're balanced. I think when you look at them, about 9 of the recommendations deal with policy, coordination, things that we can address under leadership of John Selig. But then others are going to demand a greater investment of resources.
The head of the Department of Human Services, John Selig, you know, acknowledged that the report was fair. The investigation, when the governor called for it, was unclear whether it was going to be an indictment of DHS and the way that it had been treating children because of some of the stories that had come out. And it sounds like he was accepting that the report had acknowledged that the system was functioning well in certain ways under the duress, the conditions that the caseworkers were experiencing. So this is John Selig, the head of DHS, acknowledging the findings of the report.
I thought it was a very balanced report. It gives us a great roadmap. And one thing I've learned about you, Governor, is when you think something makes sense, you don't hesitate to make a decision. So we in DHS really appreciate, and I know our caseworkers in DCFS will appreciate the fact that you're making a commitment to really see this through and give them some relief, so because they clearly want to do the right thing.
But as you pointed out, 22 kids in the last 6 months were sleeping in DHS offices because they couldn't find a place for them. So the funding is on the way, among some other key recommendations that the governor said he's going to implement. Paul Vincent is the author of the report. He works for the Child Welfare Policy and Practice Group.
There's a tendency when you're under this kind of pressure and you don't lack for critics to sort of circle the wagons and try to figure out all of the solutions yourself. And I've been in those shoes, and where I've seen systems been successful, and that's certainly been my experience, It's when you invited your partners in to help solve the problem.
So Vincent had run the DHS system in Alabama and was saying that the DHS staffers here had been receptive to his request for information, and some of his recommendations involved more local level control and also focusing on certain values that caseworkers seem to be losing in the midst of having such an overwhelming amount of responsibility, that if the agency focused on the needs of the kids and clarifying what their priorities were as far as like the human values that they're focused on, giving officers more local control to make decisions, I guess he was seeing that some sort of bureaucratic issues were getting in the way of their ability to work.
Chris?
No, I understand it that kids are placed in foster care because they're maltreated. And I guess in a tangential way, this report talks about child maltreatment in general. And I understand that the report showed that child fatalities in the state are at an alarming number. Did they talk about that in the press conference?
Not specifically. There was the Arkansas Child Death Review Board issued a report a few months ago, and DHS is a part of that, along with staff at the Children's Hospital and the State Police. And one issue that they found was death in sleep with infants, that there was sort of an education issue around parents not knowing that it wasn't okay to sleep with infants, and that actually a very high rate of suffocation, one of the highest in the nation. And then another issue was a slightly higher rate of teen suicide in the state. So those are other ongoing issues in the system.
And we've seen the governor twice this week talk about how state services might be lacking, whether it's in the foster care system or whether it's the prison reentry system. And one of the alternatives he's offered, in addition to additional money, additional staff, and really trying to fix some of those bureaucratic bottlenecks, for instance, there are enough foster parents applying to be foster parents, apparently. They're just having trouble getting approved oftentimes, and not because of their qualifications, just because of the screening process. There's some kind of bottleneck there is what the governor's been saying. But he's been saying that we're going to supplement our state efforts also with faith-based organizations. Do you have any idea to the extent that he plans for them to be involved? I imagine this is going to be troublesome for a lot of people who, you know, obviously each faith has its own appeal.
Well, we've seen that in the last few months with the Department of Community Correction reaching out to faith-based groups to be vendors and volunteers in the reentry process. And now the governor's launched this summit with an interfaith group of leaders to talk about the prison system and the foster care system. It sounds like those are really initial conversations, and that those faith leaders are going to be given the freedom to draw on their faith and their religious practice in the way that they approach these problems. It sounds very preliminary in the extent that those groups have actually gotten involved in really being partners and doing anything.
Well, I guess we'll see what comes out of that summit. There's also been a series of updates this week from the healthcare task force that's charged with figuring out the future of Arkansas's Medicaid program by the end of this year. The private option is going to expire in 2017. The big news that came out of this week is that 25,000 people are going to lose their healthcare coverage through Medicaid. Chris, can you walk us through a little bit about who these people are, what their incomes are, and a little bit about why they lost their coverage?
So far, I believe the DHS has said that upwards of 250,000 Arkansans have been determined eligible for the private option, which uses Medicaid money available through the federal government, and eventually the state will have to pitch in the coming years to fund private insurance coverage for this group of people. Mainly for an individual, it's somebody living at an income of $16,000 or less.
And the Affordable Care Act helped expand that. It used to be you had to make even less money.
Right. It was a state-by-state determination in Arkansas. The income threshold was much less. So this number, this 250,000 eligibility number, has been steadily increasing since the private option was first implemented. And, you know, I think you and I have talked about that, you know, there have been some kind of grumblings by Republican legislators, especially wondering, you know, if this is going to be an ever-expanding program, if like more and more people are just going to get on it and there will be no check. So I guess through some pressure by the legislature, the DHS has been assessing the eligibility of this group of people.
And how have they been doing that?
Well, they sent a few thousand people notices, allowing them 10 days, essentially, to prove they meet the income threshold. And if this group of people didn't respond within the 10 days, and the department says they add a few days of buffer in between, you know, they lose their eligibility and they lose their insurance, basically, until they can prove it.
And conservative legislators, who may be about a quarter of the population, never approved of this Medicaid expansion, a quarter of the legislators. And, you know, the phrase that is commonly used is scrubbing the Medicaid rolls. So that's what they're going through. And so that you mentioned they're going through 600,000 or so, everyone in the Medicaid population or near it, and they've gone through about 90,000 or so far. So we can imagine this number, this 25,000 number, could grow pretty significantly. And that's a lot of people to lose their insurance. And it could mean they're making more money and now they qualify for subsidies through the healthcare exchange.
Yeah, but as we know, the healthcare exchange, the open enrollment deadline has already passed, so they'd have to wait until next year to
stuck in limbo.
Yeah, exactly.
Chris or Jacob, do you know if this is how other states are approaching re-enrollment this year, if they're requiring enrollees to take that initiative to prove once again that they're eligible?
You know, I have no idea how other states are really, what their process of income verification is for that Medicaid expansion population. I will say, while Arkansas is having yielding to conservative pressure to look through Medicaid rolls again to re-verify this, and some legislators are calling for even more frequent checks of income verification, Alaska's governor has decided to unilaterally try to implement Medicaid expansion just this week. So the battle continues in other states as well. And while that one aspect of healthcare, the Medicaid expansion population verifying their income, is ongoing, we heard a couple updates this week also from the Steven Group, which is the consulting group that the healthcare task force has hired to help weed through this process with them. And some good news, actually, on the coordination front. Bill Golden, who works for the Centers for Medical Services, he's the director there, he told lawmakers of the healthcare task force this week that the state really has been remarkable in terms of its coordination and case management in some levels.
I would say that if you look across the country, the scale of what we've accomplished and the engagement that we've accomplished in the state has been really second to none. We have done extremely well, and it has gotten the attention of the national program, and people are looking to adopt us. A number of states now are adopting our model.
And he was referring specifically to something called the patient-centered medical home. Arkansas health officials really tout this as one of the greatest cost-controlling measures that can come about through all the federal health care reform and through state-level health care reform since then. And that the idea is really just keeping a chain of command, a chain of care, if you will, so that people will go to primary care doctors instead of the ER and things like that, and so there'll be a larger coordination of care and communication between doctors. But Bill Golden also said, while the state is doing well for some of those, for some primary care physicians and other things, the state is not doing a good job at maintaining high-cost patients. And that makes a big deal when you look at the top utilizers in a healthcare system that really add on a lot of the costs. And those tend to be more vulnerable, medically frail groups, like senior citizens, the disabled, and the like.
I think this is very instructive. If we looked at the other states, we found in our interviews with the department, there isn't a lot of effort put on care coordination and case management in the behavioral health and in the long-term care areas. And you look at, then we went to Truven, where some of the national data to try to understand where are you compared to other states. And then you look at your expenditure per resident on case management. And this is a very telling slide. And it's one that Richard will be talking about in more detail. And we'll have this in our final recommendations. Because you're going to see, you don't pay a lot for care coordination in this state. You don't pay a lot for case management.
So that was a preliminary recommendation from the Steven Group. In October, they're going to have their final recommendations to the healthcare task force about what they think the state should do to help deal with some of these Medicaid issues and control costs. In Arkansas's Medicaid costs, we're told, is around 2% annual growth, which is below the national average. So Arkansas is doing all right in that regard. So the Steven Group is calling for additional investment in those areas of coordinating for long-term care and behavioral services. But While that might save money in the long term, it's a tough sale for a legislature that really doesn't want to invest a lot of additional money in these types of things. Senator Jim Hendren, he's the chair of this task force. He's also the Senate Majority Leader and a relative of Asa Hutchinson and someone who's opposed the private option in the past.
As his data showed there, we're spending far less on case management or managed care, whatever you want to call it, than a lot of other states. But we have to find out if they're getting their bang for their buck. And that's why I asked him to do a correlation between the states that are spending a lot for managed care and what's their total per member per month cost and their total growth rates to see if it's a worthwhile investment.
And just to finish this off and put in a little bit of perspective in terms of how much Arkansas invests in that coordinated care based on episodes and things like that, Arkansas ranks 40th. We spend about 86 cents for case management for those individuals versus the national average of $8.50.
I'm wondering, when we talk about case management and these managed care cases, I mean, these are real people. What options are available to them? I mean, like, what is their experience through the healthcare system?
Well, I imagine their experience differs for different people, but in general, it's a lot about not just the patients, but the providers talking to each other. So that providers in a certain area that you could go from specialist to primary care physician, that they'd be able to have a better idea of the type of drugs they're prescribing, the types of services that are available, things like that. Or it could be even something more trivial sounding that experts say really matters a lot, such as 24/7 phone line access to your doctor's service. That could save you a trip to the ER if you talk to someone on your primary care physician on a 24/7 phone line. And so they're saying among those providers participating in patient-centered medical homes, that's gone up from 50% participation rate in that phone call type of exchange to 100%. But even that was something that Missy Irvin, who's another person who's been on the fence constantly whether to approve these medical-type programs, she didn't really even believe that it happened, that improvement had happened.
There are a lot of doctors out there that do provide 24/7 phone access for their patients.
We had a survey 2 or 3 years ago that showed that 50% of practices in primary care in the state had an answering machine.
Okay. Well, again, I think 24/7 phone access, that's a broad statement. That's not factual, because there are people doing that.
No,
and I'm not sure the results of your survey. I don't want to get into that argument. I want to just make some factual statements and corrections.
That is a factual statement.
And mine is as well, sir.
So you can tell that, you know, people who are opposed to any kind of greater investment in healthcare, everything is very contentious.
Jacob, what is the Stephen Group interest in this particular issue? We have the Walton Foundation involved in education, writing the Forward Arkansas report, and new appointments to the State Board of Education with a background in the Walmart leadership. I wonder if Stephen has a particular interest in the healthcare industry in the state.
That's a question that should be delved into a little deeper. It was kind of interesting, their selection process. There were, I believe, 5 or 6 different companies that bid for the healthcare task force to try to do this comprehensive analysis of the state's Medicaid program. In part, they might have got it because their requirement for their contract was around $1 million. There's some companies that asked for well more than that. But it's a really interesting coalition of people that approved it. A lot of the Republican leadership in that committee, including Senator Hendren, did not want the Stephen Group. They wanted a different group. This is a group based out of New Hampshire. They've done similar studies for other states. And there was a lot of Democrats who obviously want to keep the private option, want to keep expanded Medicaid funding. And a lot of Tea Party Republican-type people who really wanted income verification and things like that. So it is an odd mixture that whatever their personal motivation is, of course, they are a healthcare analytics company, so that's what they do, but they might have some other vested interests. That's certainly possible. But there was a wide array in the political spectrum that picked them.
Now, the healthcare task force has been meeting for a while now, and I was wondering if you could remind us, like, going forward, the big picture, what's at stake? What else are they having to contend with?
Well, there's been massive overhaul in every area of healthcare since the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2009, and the state has had to implement various parts of it. And in 2013, the state decided to expand Medicaid, which is what you talked about earlier in terms of the income populations that are eligible for this healthcare coverage. And so every single year, Arkansas has had a big battle in the legislature about whether or not to continue that Medicaid expansion, which gives 250,000-odd Arkansans not free, but basically free private health insurance instead of going through the Medicaid program. As this has happened, it was originally passed. There were 49 out of 100 state representatives, or 51 out of 100 state representatives were Democrats. So it was a coalition of Democrats and Republicans. Since then, the last election, Republicans have really taken control of the entire state government and really increased their margins in the state legislature. So there's a big compromise. The private option is going to end in 2017, and so it's the job of this healthcare task force to figure out, what are we going to do when the private option ends? Do those people simply lose their insurance? Are we going to reauthorize this program that many Republicans don't want?
Or simply rebrand it.
So we'll find out, and there's so many different tangential issues that we're tackling in regard to Medicaid besides the private option as well.
And I guess that state-based exchange is still underway as a strong possibility?
Yes, the state-based exchange, which we talked about in the wake of the King versus Burwell United States Supreme Court decision, that's still a possibility. It seems likely at this point. We have over $100 million from the federal government from a grant to build a state-based exchange. It's supposed to launch in 2017. It needs legislative approval as well. So you've got to imagine that anything that this healthcare task force concocts or plans will have that eventuality in mind as well. Let's move on a little bit. We had a pretty big deal in international relations this week, a deal between Iran, the United States, and five other major world powers. Chris, can you give us a summary? You listened to Senator Cotton's remarks and a little bit about the president as well. He had a press conference in addition to his speech on Tuesday.
Yeah, well, for like 20 months or so, it's been a key foreign policy area of the Obama administration to negotiate with Iran, the Islamic nation, who, as we all know, has been no friend to the United States over the last 30 or 40 some odd years, to prevent them from seeking a nuclear weapon. Now, we heard Mr. Obama, the president, say this over and over again this week, that the key point of their negotiations with that country and other world powers was to prevent them from reaching a nuclear weapon.
Because America negotiated from a position of strength and principle, we have stopped the spread of nuclear weapons in this region. Because of this deal, the international community will be able to verify that the Islamic Republic of Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon.
Iran had started a nuclear program back in the early 2000s. By now, they have upwards of thousands of centrifuges that they've been using for what they say is a peaceful program, although the rest of the world does not think that is their sole intent. So the United States and other world powers have been in negotiations, and it was announced this week that a deal had been reached. Iran would have to submit to a rigorous inspections regime, have to reduce their number of centrifuges by
two-thirds.
Two-thirds, yeah, a major amount. And they'd have to agree to a number of other stipulations as well. Of course, President Obama praised the deal, but members of Congress have expressed other views, especially the Republican members of Congress. The leading critic being our junior senator, Mr. Tom Cotton.
It's easy to criticize the deal using the president's own words. When we started down this path, he said the goal was to dismantle Iran's nuclear program. This leaves their nuclear program entirely intact. They can get a nuclear weapon if they violate the deal, as they've done with every agreement in the past, or they can get a nuclear weapon if they follow the deal in a mere 10 to 15 years. The president himself has admitted that. That's why this deal is so dangerous.
Right, and he interjected himself into the debate back when these negotiations were ongoing, when he sent an open letter to the leaders of Iran saying that Congress could derail any agreement that you're trying to make right now, and the next president could opt not to enforce it as well. So he's been trying to dismantle these negotiations from the beginning.
Yeah, and that letter was signed on to by 46 other Republican senators, including John Bozeman.
Certainly not a fringe position. Probably the majority of Congress would vote to scrap this deal, I'd imagine.
Yes, but it would stand a veto by the president, which they wouldn't be able to override.
And we'll see what happens. The Congress has about 60 days to review this deal, and they're going to try to pass new sanctions, but the president said he's vetoed those. But we'll see, and it's not just Congressman Cotton. It's the rest of the Arkansas delegation, and I spoke with Rick Crawford, the U.S. representative from the 1st District, and in addition to just panning this deal, believing the inspections won't work, that Iran has no interest in a nuclear program for anything other than building missiles. He also said that the president wasn't taking this seriously, but he thought that no negotiations should have ever taken place, let alone evaluating the worthiness of this deal.
I think everybody agreed at that point that was probably not a good idea, that you would essentially sit down and validate the opinion of a rogue nation whose primary mission is to eradicate the nation of Israel, and who has a very aggressive anti-America protocol. So I don't think it was in our interest at all to be negotiating with them, and to what end, I'm still not sure.
Of course, the president has said several times, you know, we've negotiated with the Soviet Union before with nuclear arms treaties. Republican President Ronald Reagan led those negotiations. But for Bruce Westerman, he also thinks that the negotiations should have never taken place as long as Iran is as hostile toward Israel as it says it is, and as long as it's funding terrorist groups in Yemen and Syria, although Iran is also funding Shiite militias to the benefit of the United States in Iraq and fighting ISIS. So kind of interesting there. But Representative Westerman from the 4th District, Hot Springs, Dardanelle, places like that.
The fact that they're sponsoring terrorism around the world, the comments that their leadership have made towards Israel and towards the West, I think we're making a grave mistake when we allow them any access to the nuclear program, or when we negotiate with them to approve some kind of nuclear program they're working on.
And while Iran has explicitly said we're going to give up our weaponization for nuclear weapons, they say we're going to continue pursuing our nuclear energy program, which, can you imagine a country telling the United States you can't have nuclear energy anymore? But Representative Westerman says they've got plenty of oil over there. They don't need nuclear power. Senator Bozeman, a little bit more nuanced than that. He did look at the actual deal itself, and he thinks that if Iran does cheat on the inspections and does try to build a weapon anyway, that by the time we find out, it'll be too late to put sanctions back in place.
If we lift the sanctions, which these are what have brought the Iranians to the table to begin with, this is why they bargained in the first place. But if we lift those sanctions and then they do cheat, and I think that there is great concern that they will cheat, what do you do at that point? And so that's really a huge problem. It would be very, very difficult to get those sanctions back in place.
But of course, the president has said that the UN Security Council does its deal not just with the United States and Iran, but also Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany, that these sanctions would snap back in place automatically within a 60-day time period.
So Senator Cotton led the effort several months ago and wrote a letter in opposition to this deal in an sort of unprecedented move to kind of undermine the president's international relationships. It seems that, you know, given the efforts of Senator Cotton, although they may be successful, I wonder what kind of fallout might happen if they're not.
As far as domestically here in our Senator Tom Cotton, it's interesting to answer your question in a roundabout way. If you read that letter that he sent, I mean, it's almost kind of didactic explanation of the American constitutional system, explaining that there are three branches of government and that Congress is composed of two bodies which act on majority will and so on and so forth. I don't know if he'll have necessarily any blowback here domestically, because it's my sense that he's in kind of also a roundabout way appealing to his constituency, promoting this sort of hardline stance, this very strong, patriotic,
uncompromising
stance, which is kind of what he ran on and what he got elected on, which has served him very well politically, I think.
Senator Bozeman touched a little bit on that, about who was at the negotiating table, and one of his major critiques was Israel wasn't at the negotiating table, Turkey wasn't, there wasn't really any regional partners. It was Iran, the United States, China, Russia, and some European countries. So, I've heard all over conservative talk radio this week the adage that if you're not at the table, you're being eaten or something like that. What is it? You know what I'm talking about?
You're the meal? I don't know.
Yeah, or something. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens in the next 60 days with Congress in terms of evaluating this Iran deal, because right now most of the conversation is our state representative saying we should have never even negotiated. We can never have a deal as long as Iran has a disfavorable disposition towards Israel. But Congressman French Hill had a more tempered view, saying it's really time for us to look into the specifics to see if we really could snap sanctions back in place. So we'll see what happens. The president obviously thinks it's a great deal. We'd cut down their uranium supply from enough to make 10 missiles right now to less than one. Most of these provisions are in effect from 10 to 25 years. We'll see what happens, though. We appreciate you, everyone, for listening to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. We took a look at the foster care system in Arkansas, the never-ending challenge of overhauling the state's Medicaid system and a little bit at Arkansas's response to the deal with Iran. We'll be back next week with the news from next week. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
And this has been A Look at Arkansas News, Politics, and More.
Are we going to talk about
the dog now?
The dog? No.
Wait.
You know what? We should talk about the dog. Who wants to start? Wait a minute. Why did you say we should talk about the dog and now no one wants to talk about the dog?
We had talked about talking about the dog, but
Okay, forget it. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm not prepared to. My bad.
Let me just figure out what to say so we can end this thing.